The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guest on Off the Shelf is Jack Horan. Jack is a partner with the law firm Dentons LLP, formerly McKenna Long & Aldridge LLP here in Washington, D.C. Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roger.
Well, I'm looking forward to the conversation as always, Jack. What we're going to focus on today is the Civil False Claims Act, an area where your expertise provides great insights to, I know, our member companies at the Coalition for Government Procurement. And we're going to talk about some of the key trends and developments over the last year. And I think there's sort of two, obviously there's good things and bad things. And so why don't we start first with the good things? What's going on in Civil False Claims Act litigation and case law that are looking better for government contractors?
Yeah, there's two things in particular, Roger, that have happened in the past half year or so. In 2015 that I think have been helpful to government contractors. The first is a Supreme Court decision, which is, as you know, are relatively rare in the government contracts arena, but a Supreme Court decision was issued this year that had some good news and bad news for government contractors. The good news first, the Supreme Court in a case where KBR was the litigant reviewed a Fourth Circuit decision that held that the Wartime Statute of Limitations Act applied to the Civil False Claims Act to toll the statute of limitations while the country, while the U.S. was at a state of war, which has troubled some contractors since the Fourth Circuit has issued that decision.
So let's actually break that down a little bit. So the war, what is it called again? The war?
Wartime Statute of Limitations Act.
Okay, so that waived essentially said there's no statute of limitations.
It essentially said the statute of limitations, which is typically 6 years under the False Claims Act, was tolled during the period where the U.S. is at war. And then to complicate matters further, it defined war fairly broadly to include the authorization to use military force. So the factual background was KBR was sued under the False Claims Act by Keetam Relator. I think it was a former employee. KBR defended its lawsuit on the basis that the lawsuit was filed after the statute of limitations, and the relator and the government took the position that the 6-year statute of limitations had been tolled because the U.S., under the definition of war for this statute, was at a state of war, so the statute of limitations didn't apply.
So I'm thinking about that, and I'm just even thinking about things that almost happen not on a daily basis, but at least a monthly basis, right? You'll see news reports of, another, drone attack on, the Taliban leader or somebody or ISIS now we got that going on too. So theoretically, and those are, I guess, theoretically authorized by the government. So, and you could argue that's an act of war, right?
That's right. The specific language of the statute was war is defined as authorization to use military force. So it didn't require a declaration of war. And that was the concern of the industry, that by that definition of war, the authorization to use military force, it could toll the statute of limitations for quite some time. Arguably, it was tolled ever since 9/11,
right.
And continues to be tolled.
Right. As long as we have the war on terror or whatever its latest iteration is called, you could theoretically never have a statute of limitations for.
That's right.
And the contract involved support of the war effort. Was that an issue too? Because when you, if it's sort of wave globally, right? It could be a contract that's designed to support, you know, State Department issuance of passports, theoretically, right? Or anything like that, right? Does that?
That's right. The I believe the contract was in support of the war, but the Fourth Circuit's holding wasn't limited in that way. The Fourth Circuit found that the language of the Wartime Statute of Limitations Act covered the False Claims Act, and then the Fourth Circuit's reasoning and other courts followed that reasoning, indicated that the tolling could apply to any government contract, so regardless of whether there was any link to the war. So other courts had decided after the Fourth Circuit decided this this interpretation of the Wartime Statute of Limitations Act, that it applied to purely domestic government contracts, including financial contracts. It would certainly be interpreted prior to the Supreme Court decisions to apply to GSA schedule contracts and VA schedule contracts by the government. That was the government's position.
Okay. Well, in just one last sort of observation of this on the context of it. I mean, authorization war could mean anything. It could be like a cyber response, right? Even, right? If you're authorized to respond in some sort of offensive way to cyber attacks. Now, I don't know if we are or not, but that, I mean, theoretically, that language is, to your point, is so broad that it's like you wouldn't have a statute of limitations.
That's right. And that was the concern of industry, that it effectively eliminated the statute of limitations. Industry was also concerned because the view of industry was that the Fourth Circuit took a particularly broad interpretation of the Wartime Statute of Limitations Act. On one issue, as you've described, the interpretation of what war is, although that there wasn't a lot of quarrel with industry over that interpretation because the definition was in the statute. But what industry was particularly concerned about was the Wartime Statute of Limitations Act applied by its explicit terms to any offense involving fraud or attempted fraud against the United States.
Anyone.
That's yeah. Right. And the industry viewed the term offense as limiting, as meaning a criminal offense, as it's typically used. But the Fourth Circuit viewed that term much more broadly to say it wasn't limited to criminal cases and applied to the False Claims Act. So at the end of the day, with the Fourth Circuit's decision, industry was concerned, and the concern was a valid one because courts were following the Fourth Circuit, that there was no longer a statute of limitations because we've been effectively at a state of war by that definition.
And so, I mean, so why is it a bad thing not to have a statute of limitations?
Well, for all the reasons, it's a good thing to have a statute of limitations. Presumably, without a statute of limitations, you could go back many years and look at the conduct. The contractor would be in a position where it would be very difficult for them to defend, arguably, because employees have moved on, records are no longer retained. So it's much more difficult, in my experience, to defend a False Claims Act case against the government based on conduct that was 10 or 15 years old than conduct that was 5 years old.
Right. And that goes to, you know, basically, to me, is an issue too of certainty and risk and allocation of risk. And you have to have some defined rules of the road and a timeline. Otherwise, it becomes, to me, it would become impossible to do business because you're always having to, you'd never have a, okay, I don't have to worry about that one anymore, right? I've always got to, I mean, to me, that's exponentially costly for both government and industry to a point where it doesn't make good business sense.
I agree. And it's particularly problematic. I know lots of your members and hopefully listeners are schedule contractors.
Of course they're listeners too, Jack. And come on.
It's particularly troubling in my view for those type of contracts because you have 10 and 20 year contracts.
Right.
And you have an audit coming oftentimes during a renewal period,
yes,
where the contract has been 5 or 10 years in underperformance, and the government could take the position, again, prior to the Supreme Court decision, that there's no statute of limitations for those contracts, at least back to 2001 and maybe even back further than that.
Right. You know what, Jack? Geez, we spent a whole segment talking about what war is, what it isn't, you know, an offense and what the statute of limitations is all about. But when we come back, I just want to give you a moment to sort of explain the Supreme Court's decision, their rationale, and why it's a good thing. And then we can move on to some of the other Civil False Claims Act issues. My guest today is Jack Horan. He is a partner at Denton's LLP. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
These days, it seems everyone's talking about the new normal, but federal agencies have a chance to define it. How will you shape your future? Turn to Deloitte. We understand what makes America work and how it can work better. With our private sector insight and public sector experience, we can help you rethink, reduce, and restructure, or even change the game. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. Wherever you need to go, Deloitte sees you there.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jack Horan. Jack is a partner at Denton's LLP, formerly McKenna Long & Aldridge LLP here in Washington, D.C. And today we are talking Civil False Claims Act. And, you know, that's an area of great concern for both government and industry. The rules of that road, what does it mean? It's an interesting dynamic that federal contracts is a place where you have these penalties that could theoretically be imposed on government contractors for issues relating to contract performance beyond your traditional contract disputes. And there's nobody better to talk about it than Jack Horan with his vast experience at DOJ and in the private sector, working on behalf of companies in this area. So, Jack, I promised you an opportunity to sort of explain the Supreme Court decision when we come back, and then we'll move on to a couple other issues. So, and we're talking KBR and the statute of limitations in the first segment. So what exactly did the Supreme Court hold on that?
Okay. The KBR appealed the case to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court took the case, which, as you know, Roger, isn't by any means a
I'll create all kinds of buzz, right?
That's right.
Government contracts bar. Oh, my God, we have a case at the Supreme Court.
It's by no means guaranteed. Right. So the Supreme Court viewed it as an important issue as well. And I'm pleased to say the Supreme Court rejected the Fourth Circuit's reasoning on the statute of limitations. As we discussed, there's really two issues, and the Supreme Court focused on one of those two statute of limitations issues. The first of the issues, which we spent some time on, is what does it mean to be at war?
Yeah.
And that wasn't a focus of the Supreme Court decision. The other issue that we discussed was what did the word offense mean in the wartime statute of limitations act? Did it cover civil cases or civil false claims act, or was it limited to, as much of industry believed, criminal cases based on the typical definition of offense? And the Supreme Court found and interpreted similarly to industry. The Supreme Court found that offense, as typically used in statutes, does not cover civil false claims act or civil cases. It's limited to criminal cases. So they limited the coverage of the wartime statute of limitations act to criminal offenses. It was an interesting, from a legal point of view, it was an interesting analysis because it brought in the typical analysis of statutory interpretation. You look at the language of the statute, what did Congress mean? And as I said,
read it as a whole, right?
Read it as a whole.
Meaning to all the words, kind of all that good stuff.
And what to give a full picture of what the Fourth Circuit had decided, the former language of the statute didn't just say offense, it said a now indictable defense. Mm. The Fourth Circuit interpreted the deletion of now indictable to mean that to the extent Congress may have originally limited offense to criminal cases,
right,
they expanded it. The Supreme Court disagreed, said that the now indictable language was eliminated for a different reason, to include coverage of both past and future criminal offenses.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And also commented that such a significant policy change would not typically be implemented by Congress by a relatively minor statutory language change.
Sure.
So the bottom line is contractors no longer have to worry about a indefinite statute of limitations under the False Claims Act. They're back to the statutory statute of limitations, which has its own problems, and we can talk about that someday.
But, okay.
That's good news. That's very good news, particularly, again, in my view, for scheduled contract holders, because that limits it to likely to 6 years.
Right. Hey, so there's some other good news in this arena, developments that you want to talk about, and I think it's the case, the implied certification theory of liability. And
that's right.
Can you talk a little bit about what is the implied certification theory, first of all?
Yes, the implied certification theory has been developed by both the government and QTAM relators, in my view, to bring under the False Claims Act contract and regulatory violations that aren't specifically incorporated into a contract. So the theory is that a claim can be legally false even if it's not factually false. And the theory behind the implied certification theory, or the rationale behind the implied certification theory, is that when a contractor submits a invoice for payment, a claim for payment to the government, it has implicitly certified that it's compliant with all major contractual, regulatory, and statutory requirements. The case that's good news for the contractor is a Seventh Circuit case where the Seventh Circuit rejected the implied certification theory, which is rare in itself. Most of the other, by the vast majority of the other circuits that have looked into this have accepted the implied certification theory. The background of the case, it's United States v. Sanford Brown, was, again, it was a QTAM case. A former employee brought a case against a educational provider that the former employee alleged that the educational provider was not compliant with some of the underlying regulatory requirements to receive student loans, I believe it was, for the provision of educational services. But those underlying regulatory requirements were not a requirement of the or were not stated on the claims that were submitted to the government. They were based on the regulations that apply to the educational provider. The Second Circuit looked at that and said, adopting a policy position that I think contractors would agree with, that something as significant as fraud cannot be based on implied certifications, that it has to be more more specific than that, more explicit than that. And if you do base it on implied certifications, you're expanding the possibility of False Claims Act liability significantly, and that would be unfair to contractors.
Right. Well, I mean, it would theoretically, one could argue, it expand it infinitely, right? I mean, there's all kinds. I'm a law-abiding citizen, right? I've paid my taxes. Like, well, we've seen Congress and people get all spun up about contractors who are receiving money but haven't allegedly paid their taxes. I mean, I guess you could theoretically take it to that kind of extreme or not.
Yeah, I think that would be difficult. even the implied certification theory limited the liability to statutes or regulations that were connected to the underlying program.
And the contract or whatever that was, or the transaction that was the basis of the of the claim.
That's right. So that would be even a very aggressive view of the implied certification theory. But it would make it pretty broad. In the healthcare area, it could mean healthcare provider who's not compliant with certain regulations that have to do with healthcare, the provision of healthcare and not the contractual or reimbursement aspects of it, could be held liable.
Okay. So, and this is good news again. Why? For contractors?
Well, it's good news for contractors who are going to be sued in the Seventh Circuit.
Okay. I wanted to get that point out there.
That's right. Well, what the Seventh Circuit held was that the regulations that need to be complied with to enter the program can only be the basis for a False Claims Act case if the contractor, or the defendant in those cases, intended not to comply with those regulations when they entered the program. The fact that they didn't comply with those regulations, arguably at sometime later, doesn't provide a false basis for a False Claims Act case. So it limited the application of the False Claims Act significantly to either express violations of the, violations of express requirements of the claim, or situations where the contractor intended to violate the applicable regulations at the time of entering the program. And I think, you know, a fair application of that case, the contractors would be, if you violate some type of regulatory requirement or even contractual requirement at the time of submitting the claim, your invoice, that doesn't make you liable. You would only be liable as when you entered the contract, you intended to violate those requirements, significant narrowing of the liability.
Okay. And Jack, we're already up on the break for this segment. When we come back, we'll be talking more to Jack Horan. He is a partner at Denton's LLP. And when we come back, we'll talk about some of the bad news that's out there. And we'll go back to the KBR case and get the, you know, the court giveth and the court taketh away. It's some little bit bad news in that case as well. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jack Horan. He is a partner at Denton's LLP, formerly McKenna, Long & Aldridge LLP here in Washington, D.C. And we're talking Civil False Claims Act and good news and bad news for government contractors. And we've talked a lot about two cases that represent good news for government contractors. Now, unfortunately, to most, I guess, or to government contractors, we're going to talk a little bit about some bad news. And the first issue I think, Jack, you want to talk about is going back to the KBR Supreme Court case and some bad news that did come out of that case from a government contractor's perspective, at least. Not to the relators and others, but...
No, the relators, I think,
they're very happy, right?
Yes. Okay. The Supreme Court in the KBR case also reviewed another aspect of the False Claims Act, and that is the application of what is typically referred to as the first-to-file rule. And the first-to-file rule, Roger, as you know, provides that no person other than the government can bring a related False Claims Act action based on the facts underlying a pending action. So the idea behind the first-to-file rule is to eliminate opportunistic lawsuits where someone hears of
copycat
a false claims
kind of thing,
copycat
right?
lawsuits where someone hears of False Claims Act behavior and then races to the courthouse to file another action. KBR and industry, I think, took the position, would typically, and industry would agree with KBR in this position, that the first to file rule prevents a subsequent filing as long as there's been a previous filing, whether dismissed or not, based on the same facts.
Mm-hmm.
The government's position on the first to file rule focused on the term pending in the first to file rule, and the government took the position that, and the relators took the position that, a subsequent lawsuit is only barred if the first lawsuit is still pending. So if the first lawsuit was dismissed without prejudice or in any way, a QTAM relator can file a subsequent lawsuit if they meet the other conditions of the False Claims Act based on the identical facts. So industry was hoping that the Supreme Court would come out on in favor of its interpretation, KBR's interpretation. The government, of course, was hopeful that it would only limit subsequent filing when the first filing is still pending. And the Supreme Court agreed with the QTAM relators and the government in that aspect of the case. The Supreme Court held that the first-to-file rule only bars subsequent filing when the original filing is still pending. If it was dismissed, the subsequent filing isn't barred, which allows for a contractor to have to defend against the same facts underlying a False Claims Act case sequentially, even after the original case was dismissed.
That doesn't apply to a situation where a case has been resolved, or do people tweak the facts slightly even though?
Yeah, it doesn't.
How does it address that? I mean, I'm thinking about those variations. That's why I was trying to run through my mind, like, how do you get around that
right.
or And so what do people do in that situation? Do they alter the facts slightly, or do they rely on other aspects of it, but is generally the same thing? Or
yeah, well, based on the Supreme Court's ruling, and the Supreme Court recognized that its ruling could result in some unusual circumstances. But based on the Supreme Court's ruling, the subsequent relator doesn't have to do anything. They can use the identical facts as long as the first case is no longer pending. So if the first case has been voluntarily dismissed, or the contractor has succeeded in dismissing the case under some of the procedural or even substantive basis in which a district court case can be dismissed, the new relator can still bring the subsequent case without being concerned about the first to file rule. Where that poses a problem is if a contractor faced these facts with a relator and was able to get it dismissed, for example, on Rule 9B, which requires specific allegations.
Sure.
And the case was dismissed without prejudice. Another relator coming along could file the identical case, or even that same relator could file that identical case if they'd done some additional research, perhaps survive that 9B motion, and the contractor would then be defending that case all over again, essentially.
So let me ask you a follow-up question, since you asked if I had any questions. Thanks, Jack. So is it theoretically possible that a relator could merely look at the filings of something that's been dismissed for whatever reason, Rule 9B or whatever, and take that information and then use it to do their own research and then file something subsequently? They could be completely unrelated to the whole transaction. Like, because we usually, when you think about QTAM, oftentimes it's employees who of a company who identify something they are concerned about, or, you know, is that theoretically what I just described possible under this scenario?
I think so. I mean, there are other procedural restrictions.
Because that's troublesome in and of itself. Right.
There are other procedural restrictions on the False Claims Act filing that may cause that to be difficult.
Yeah.
But the first to file bar would not necessarily preclude that case because a previous case has been filed. And where it probably applies more often, I would think, in practice, is the same relator. If the relator takes a shot at it, loses it under 9B, can spend more time trying to research it and then file the case.
Right.
We
can move on to the second.
Okay.
Jack, you should do the show. You've been there.
The second bad news for the contractor, second case that provides bad news for the contractor, is U.S. v. Triple Canopy, which was a case, again, in the Fourth Circuit. Fourth Circuit hasn't been great for a law that favors the contractor over the past year. And that's an implied certification case where the Fourth Circuit, although it was somewhat reluctant to use the implied certification terminology, weighed in favor of implied certification. The Fourth Circuit, of course, is an important circuit because of its location in Virginia, among other places.
Mm-hmm. And government contractors are there.
Government contractors are there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what happened in Triple Canopy was a contractor that had security contract with the government. And the relator alleged, I believe it was a relator case, and the government alleged that Triple Canopy falsified marksmanship tests that were a requirement of the contract. It was an implied certification case because when Triple Canopy submitted its invoices and claims, it never certified that its employees met the marksmanship requirement. So the government's theory was this is a material requirement of the contract. Doesn't matter if it's not an express requirement of the invoice or for payment, it's an implied certification violation. And the Fourth Circuit agreed with the government there and indicated that the failure to meet the marksmanship requirements was a basis for a False Claims Act, even if it wasn't a explicit certification.
Well, you know, there's so much there. I mean, that, you know, when you describe that, it reminds me of, you know, something that the oversight community is looking at, resumes, right? And the idea, like if somebody's billed at a particular labor rate and there's labor qualifications. And they look at that person's they're reviewing resumes and whatever to make sure that person qualifies at a particular category. And regardless of whether the performance was satisfactorily met the government's needs or not,
is that
the first thing I thought of.
I think that's a excellent analogy, and I think it places. I think what you're referring to is particularly under FSS schedules. One concern of the government is a contractor providing unqualified labor, regardless of how well the labor performs. If they say they're going to have a college degree, the government's view is they have to have a college degree, for example.
Right.
And I think the Triple Canopy case firmly establishes that those type of cases can be the basis for a False Claims Act case, even though the requirement isn't an explicit requirement for payment.
Right. Oh, Jack, you know what? We're already up on the break. When we come back, I got a couple other questions about Triple Canopy on this implied certification issue. And then we'll look at some bigger picture trends. And I also want to ask you about GSA's transactional data reporting rule and the reporting of prices paid. And does that create any liability issues in your mind? My guest today is Jack Horan. He's a partner at Denton's LLP. And you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jack Horan. He is a partner at Denton's LLP. And Jack, last segment, you ended it. You talked about another bad trend, this implied certification rule, the Triple Canopy case. And, you know, there's sort of two, I actually have two questions. You know, the first one's more specific, is that I get a sense out there too, what kind of contract was a Triple Canopy contract, or does that even matter? Because I get a sense out there in the industry that even in cases where we talked about labor rates and resumes, even in situations where the contract is firm fixed price, the government, especially on schedules, appears to be or what is trying to break down those cost elements of that firm fixed price, and then taking that a step further and looking at resumes of people to compare to those cost elements, or i.e. labor rates, even though the task order is firm fixed price and it's a price X for performance of Y. I mean, is that something you're seeing, or do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Triple Canopy, I'm not certain, but I think it was probably a time and materials contract.
Yeah, that makes
sense. I think the rationale in Triple Canopy and applied certification generally would not be limited to those type of contracts and could apply to firm fixed price contracts. And the government's theory there would be, well, we paid you a firm fixed price, but we paid you a firm fixed price for guards, in the example of Triple Canopy, who met some type of marksmanship requirements. By providing us guards that did not meet those marksmanship requirements, you provided us kind of the equivalent, Roger, of a substandard part, but for
right,
services.
Gray market.
So you provided us less than what we paid for, and even if it's a firm fixed price, we were entitled to what we got paid. Like I said, it'd be similar to dressing up an aluminum bolt as a titanium bolt. The government's view was, sure, that is a firm fixed price contract, but you didn't give us what we paid for in the services context.
I guess my other question is, in the context of applied certification. So let's take the Civil False Claims Act out of a second. I mean, would there be a contract dispute potential? I mean, wouldn't that be a better way to handle it? Like a contract claim as opposed to turning this into, these potentially punitive, in my view, damages?
Yes. Arguably, yes. And that's the tension between the circuits that have accepted implied certification and the circuit that hasn't now. Is drawing a line around what is fraud if it's not limited to an express certification. And bad facts, as they say, make bad law. I think a lot of people intuitively would say Triple Canopy, it had to come out that way because how could you have guards that maybe can't shoot?
Right.
But
I could see that.
But it's difficult when you get to it's difficult to, first of all, rule against that and say, no, it's not an express requirement, so no False Claims Act violation. But it's also difficult if you include implied certifications drawing a circle around what is a material violation. The Fourth Circuit said that can be that abuse that could result from implied certification could be can be mitigated by strict enforcement of the scienter and materiality requirements of government contracts. So even though you can't tell what's a false claim by what's written in the contract, it has to be material, and
right,
someone will have to decide that. And you have to intend under the False Claims Act standard of mens rea to or scienter to violate the contract. It can't be an inadvertent violation. The problem I have with that is, first of all, the scienter requirement is very broad in itself under the False Claims Act. It includes reckless disregard. So that's not a lot of protection. And secondly, and perhaps more importantly, those decisions are very difficult to get resolved other than through the completion of litigation for a jury to decide that. So you've put the contractors in the circumstances or situation when someone makes an implied certification argument that they're likely going to have to defend it right to the end. And there's no easy easy oversight to say or standard oversight for a court to say, no, this is not material. This isn't, does it meet the scienter requirements? You can dismiss, you know, we'll dismiss
sure.
the case.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's move on. I know there's some sort of continuing trends out there. Can you touch on some of those real briefly?
I can. And most of them, I think, are of interest to the government contract community more broadly. But essentially, what I've noticed and other commentators have noticed is that the False Claims Act are still very, very important. They are primarily or more focused now in the healthcare arena, but procurement is still a central focus of DOJ and key TAM relators.
Lots of money in healthcare, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And if you look at False Claims Act cases, there's been an evolution of more cases being filed by key TAM relators than DOJ for about 20 years now. When the False Claims Act statute was first changed in 85 or 86, DOJ filed the majority of False Claims Act cases. Now that is no longer the case and hasn't been the case for a while. So it means you have to pay attention.
Hey, they're letting the private sector do it, right?
Well, and you also, from a contractor's point of view, you have to, that means you have to pay attention to your
employees
and make sure their concerns are addressed.
Right. And you have business compliance programs and ethics programs in place for your company employees.
And for the members of the coalition and GSA and VA contractors, having looked at the data and the recent cases, it's also clear that for GSA and VA contractors, the risk is still primarily around the four traditional areas, which are false commercial sales practices disclosures as a basis for a False Claims Act, failure to comply with the price reduction clause, Trade Agreements Act violations, and as we've discussed earlier in this call, earlier in this show, a failure to provide.
That's okay, Jack. You could have been calling in, but you're live in studio. So
a failure to provide with the labor requirements. Those are the four key areas currently for GSA and VA contractors.
Yeah, it's a sort of mixed bag of things there in terms of good and bad. But on the horizon, which could become a trend, is data transaction reporting. You know, the GSA back in the spring issued a proposed rule with regard to transactional data reporting for task order pricing, BPA pricing under the GSA Schedules program that would essentially require contractors to report all transactional pricing. I know there's been commentary and analysis of the rule. You know, the coalition obviously has taken our positions on it. But more generally, from a legal perspective, there's been some concern out there about what does it mean for government contractors that now there's sort of two aspects of it. Number one, they have to report all this transaction information. What happens if they don't report that accurately? Is that an implied certification or even a mandatory performance requirement that creates implied certification? And number two, the other aspect of it is GSA in the rule made it clear that they were continuing to be able to ask for updated CSPs, even if they were going to waive the price reduction clause. I think those two things have raised significant concern in industry. Do you have any thoughts on those?
I do. I'm concerned as well, and I think industry is correct to be concerned about those. As I've mentioned, for scheduled contractors, the primary area of False Claims Act liability is pricing and data reporting on pricing. And now you have a situation, if this rule goes forward, where you have a new area of data reporting that likely is going to affect pricing. I think everyone agrees that GSA is likely to use this data to affect pricing, not only for a contract, a particular contract, but across the schedule.
I said so in the rule too. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So I think you're right. It is arguably a basis for an implied certification argument, although it's not something you're representing it's not an explicit certification when you're billing the government. You're providing the government this information, knowing that the government is going to base its pricing on it. Is that a material term of the contract that could be subject to the implied certification?
Right, and it's like people said nefariously, oh, you misreported because the price, you reported a higher price. If you report a lower price, it might have impacted prices down the road.
That's right. Yeah. And I don't think it's a stretch to say that could be the basis for a False Claims Act case. And then secondly, one of the traditional areas, as I just discussed, is commercial sales practices disclosures, which anyone who's dealt with those knows they are very, very difficult to do correctly. And in fact, GSA IG every year represents that something like 60 or 70% of the contractors get those
wrong. Yeah, usually 70 to 80.
Yeah, 70 to 80 get those wrong. So now it's not just a one every 5 year event.
Right.
It's arguably every 5 years and whenever GSA decides they want to ask for that information. So it multiplies, in my view, the areas that could create False Claims Act exposure. And
right.
I would be very concerned about it, and I think the industry should be concerned about
it. And Jack, on that happy note, we do have to end the show. I want to thank my guest today, Jack Horan. He is a partner at Dentons LLP. We've been talking Civil False Claims Act, latest developments, trends, and information. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.